Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night.
Bobby Vinton, the Polish prince, was the light. Poland, of course, is a member of NATO. Today would have been Bobby Vinton's birthday. Today is Bobby Vinton's birthday, and even though, you know, he's not around anymore, we certainly have a lot of great songs, including this one. Actually, no, he is around anymore. He's 89 years old. Sorry, I didn't mean to kill off Bobby Vinton. He is alive and doing great. Well, I'll be honest, I don't know how well he's doing, but he's still alive. I'll tell you that. But he's still had a lot of great songs. He's one of those singers, very controversial. Hey, do you remember Russell Texas Bentley? Russell Texas Bentley, fascinating guy. Guy from Texas, very pro-Russian and a communist. And I discovered, I read an article where he was mentioned, but I started interviewing Russell Texas Bentley on the radio maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. And I was intrigued by this guy. Why would anyone go to Russia, or actually not even Russia? He went to one of these Eastern republics in Ukraine, one of these breakaway republics, and became part of what they called the People's Republic of Donetsk. So to me, it was just a fascinating story overall of a guy that's an American, a Texan, a veteran of the American military, chooses to become a communist, number one, then chooses to move to Ukraine, number two, then the section of Ukraine that he's in chooses to have it secede from the rest of Ukraine and be part of this breakaway country. And he's been, especially over the last few years, very much a part of this war. So we would check in with him from time to time about how things were going. And I spoke to him in January of 2022, right before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And he was describing what was going on in terms of the fighting. And because there was fighting in these Donbass republics even before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In fact, that was one of the justifications that Putin used for going into Ukraine. Here's a little bit of my discussion with Russell Texas Bentley.
The front line of the Ukrainian army is less than 5 miles from my house. You understand? There's rockets, there's cannons, there's tanks, there's snipers that do work, that do shoot frequently. I mean, there's shellings happen in my neighborhood, not every day, but probably about half of the days in a month. You know, and some of them, I mean, all of them close enough for me to hear, some of them close enough for me to smell.
And the description that he gave, not only in that conversation, but in many of our conversations over the years, was basically that he was very close to the fighting. He was participating in the fighting, and it was always very dangerous. And now, as of 3 days ago, it is being reported in both American media and Russian media that Russell Texas Bentley, this pro-Kremlin American who fought against Ukraine in 2014 and has been continually fighting against Zelensky and the Ukrainian government, has gone missing in Donetsk. So I've reached out to him. Needless to say, I haven't heard anything from him, and he's gone missing. Nobody's heard from him. So it's we don't know what his story is. Hopefully they're able to find him. Hopefully he's still alive. But it, to me, is another reminder that this war in Ukraine is still going on. You know, there are so many international crises. You have what's going on in the Middle East And by the way, it's not one thing that's going on in the Middle East. You have what's going on in Iran. You have what's going on in Gaza. You have what's going on in Lebanon. And then obviously what's going on in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Then you have all sorts of other international crises in places like Brazil, in places like Haiti, in places like Sudan. It's easy to forget that this war in Ukraine is still very serious, very serious. So much so, there are a lot of casualties on both sides. How bad those casualties are, I have no idea, because it doesn't seem like either side is exactly forthcoming with honest information about this. But you now have a situation where Ukraine, because they're suffering from a shortage of soldiers, has lowered the conscription age. They're drafting people to send to the front lines at a younger and younger age. Now, a lot of these would-be Ukrainian draftees don't want to go to the front lines, so they're doing what was being reported about a lot of Russian draftees. They're running away. They're running away and fleeing. And a very disturbing article in the New York Times over the weekend indicating that a lot of these Ukrainian men are actually dying as they're running away to avoid conscription. Someone who is one of the most studied living scholars of the Russian question that we've had on the program is Dr. Richard Sakwa. He's an emeritus professor of Russian and European politics at the University of Kent in the UK and one of the foremost experts on Russia and the author of the book, The Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. Dr. Sakwa, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let me first, before we talk about Russia and Ukraine, which is primarily what I want to talk to you about, obviously the situation with this Iranian attack on Israel over the weekend has gotten a great deal of attention, and now the world is sort of waiting to see if there's going to be additional retaliation from Israel to Iran. I'm just curious if you have any take on the current situation involving Israel and Iran.
It seems to me that all sides except Israel want to contain the conflict. Iran signaled that it was going to launch these missiles or do an action 72 hours in advance. It actually told Washington about it so that everybody was all prepared. But don't forget, this retaliation was in response to the Israeli attack on a diplomatic site on the 1st of April in Damascus, which killed 16 people, seven of whom were leading figures in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. So, and of course, that attack by Israel on that Damascus building was against the Geneva Conventions. So it was a huge act of escalation. Iran had to respond, I mean, just for strategic purposes, but it was limited. I mean, it was awful. But no one died. No one died in this. So Israel managed to fight it off. And as both Biden and the British are saying, take the win, move on. But Israel is, you know, all this talk is further action.
So, I mean, the Admiral Kirby denied that they had advanced knowledge of the Iranian attack. But a lot of people have pointed out that this seems like it was done to minimize the amount of damage and maximize the amount of opportunity for avoiding injury. You seem to think that this was an opportunity for Iran to save face because they had to respond since their embassy or their consulate was attacked, but it wasn't really done to be a serious effort to hurt anyone, kill anyone, or damage any property.
Yes, I mean, that was the outcome. A war like this, quite no one. As for the announcement, everyone knew this was coming. Even I did, well away from it. But if Admiral Kirby didn't, then he's the only one who the whole weekend.
Richard, if I can, we're having a very tough time hearing you and understanding you. If you can try and get to a better signal area of some sort, assuming you're on a mobile phone, it's tough for me to make out what you're saying.
Yeah. There's always, you know, where we are here in Kent or Canterbury, the signal is always weak.
Right.
It's a problem. And so the telephone in a different position is better.
It's not, actually. It's not. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to have you talk to Matt, and if we can try and get to an area where it's better to understand. I do have a great many questions about where this Russia-Ukraine war is going and where things are with the Middle East as well. And for the record, I did ask, you know, was this a good connection before we began the interview? And I was told it was, but so be it. Happens. All right. Hey, speaking of Russell Bentley, you know, Russell Texas Bentley, I'm not saying he's going to be remembered as being on the right side of history, but I always appreciated that even in the middle of wars, he was always willing to come on this program. And I certainly hope that he's not dead. All right. Richard Sackwood, we have you back.
Yes. Can you hear me a bit better now?
That's a bit better, yes. Dr. Sackwa, are you able to give us, just going back to this Russia-Ukraine situation, are you able to give us an idea of what you're hearing in terms of what the casualty numbers have been on either or both sides, either the Russian side or the Ukrainian side?
Yes. Well, Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, a few weeks ago, said Ukrainian casualties were 31,000. Now, this was a gross underestimate, but, you know, we don't know. But there are suggestions that Ukrainian casualties could have been up to 500,000, which is absolutely devastating. As for Russian casualties, again, we don't know. The Ukrainians and the West tend to exaggerate, but the Russian tactics have been one of attrition. So in other words, their goal has been to save their people as much as possible and to weaken the personnel involved in the fighting on the other side. So we simply don't know. I mean, it could be 50,000, it could be 150,000.
And I would think with Russia having such a large population, that, I mean, again, you hate to just think of any of these soldiers as being expendable on either side, but I would think that that's a pretty, in the long term, that's an effective strategy because the Russians have a lot more people to lose than the Ukrainians do.
At least four times as many. Russia's population today officially is 148 million. Ukraine's population is estimated now to be down to some 20 million.
Ah.
So the disparity is huge.
Wow. I alluded to the fact that the draft age is being lowered in Ukraine, and there was a report of men fleeing Ukraine to avoid the draft, including drowning as they're fleeing and people dying to avoid the draft. That's not an indication that things are going well either, is it?
I was at a conference just the other day, and a British foreign ministerial official said that morale in Ukraine and Kiev is collapsing, that they know that they're going to lose this war. It's not just a lack of manpower, it's a lack of ammunition, munitions, and indeed a sense of, you know, that they're engaged in a struggle, an unequal fight, which they simply can't win, even though they're encouraged to fight to the last Ukrainian for what they now more and more perceive to be the interests of Washington and the West in general, as opposed to their own concerns, which should have been to make a peace, to try to develop Ukraine with its huge potential, instead of which it has been squandered in a pointless, stupid, and absolutely appalling war.
Yeah, and that's what's so frustrating about this situation to me, is it would seem like we know how this outcome is likely to end, and it's probably going to look the same. The map will look the same, and the terms of the agreement that ends this conflict will look the same, whether it ends now or after another 150,000 people die and another, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars are spent in destroyed property. It's very, very, very disconcerting. But given what you just said, given the fact that Ukraine is almost certainly going to lose this war, whether it's a month, a year, or 3 years, just because of the numbers that we're dealing with here and attrition. I would think Ukraine has got to have some sort of other strategy other than begging the West for more money and more military aid. If it's as hopeless for the Ukrainian side as you make it sound, why wouldn't Zelensky try to negotiate a settlement on the best possible terms at this point?
Indeed, because the longer the war goes on, the worse the conditions and the terms for Ukraine, because Russia is anticipated to launch an offensive, maybe not a big one, but it will push forwards on all fronts, so Ukraine will lose more territory. The problem for Zelensky is twofold. First, his legitimate mandate as president ends on the 20th of May, 5 years after he was inaugurated. So his position becomes more and more fragile. Second, if he did try to negotiate, we have the old problem that the so-called anti-capitulationists, that's hardline nationalists, will move against him. So this is why he didn't implement the Minsk Accords in the first place, which would have allowed the Donbass, you were talking about it earlier, to return to Ukrainian jurisdiction. So he himself has become a victim or trapped in the logic of war, which he himself cannot escape. And of course, thirdly, Zelensky, in my view, and I've always said it, is a hopelessly inadequate political leader. We could have seen this. You saw it. I saw it. We all saw that this was a war which should have been avoided at all costs. And instead of which, he allowed himself to become a plaything of the nationalists within Ukraine and the neocons in the United States, if I may be so bold.
Hi, it's Ernie Anastas. You know, your thoughts can affect how you feel, and how you feel can impact your thoughts. Addressing your mind and body connection is the key to improving your overall wellness. Bergen Newbridge Medical Center is the largest hospital in New Jersey, providing comprehensive, equitable, compassionate, and high-quality emergency inpatient and outpatient medical care, plus mental health services and substance use disorder treatment. The Bergen Newbridge team can address your total health needs in one convenient location. Call 201-225-7130. For an appointment, or newbridgehealth.org.
Well, I think that's a very astute analysis. And if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Dr. Richard Sakwa. He's an emeritus professor of Russian and European politics at the University of Kent in the UK. Also the author of the book, The Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. The interesting thing about your book, Dr. Sakwa, is it does a great job looking at recent and long-term history. And I think that a misunderstanding of the history of the Cold War by Americans is in part why the United States got so involved in not only supporting and funding Ukraine in this conflict, but got so involved in antagonizing Russia over the course of the last decade. One of the narratives that took shape over the course of the last 30 years is that the Cold War was won by the United States, mostly because of a military buildup that the communists could not keep up with, and that the Soviet Union simply collapsed because they couldn't keep up with what we were doing in terms of building up defense. Is that accurate? One, was the Cold War won by the United States? And two, was the primary reason for the Soviet collapse not being able to keep up with dumping all sorts of American defense spending?
Both her pictures are totally false, and not only false, but dangerously so. When Mikhail Gorbachev put an end to the Cold War, and don't forget it was the Soviet Union who decided it was time to move beyond the Cold War, it was not because he felt that the West was winning in any way, or the Soviet military position was weakening, or even the economy, which could have, which was still growing. It wasn't failing as such, though it failed to deliver the sort of wealth that we would have possibly liked to have seen. But Gorbachev appealed not to a victory or not to the West. He appealed to something different, and that is to the United Nations, the Charter International System, which is more than just an institution. That is, to the idea which was there in 1945 that the world had just had the world's worst war, the Second World War, with millions of deaths and destruction. We've got to do better. And Gorbachev tried to revive that spirit of common cooperation, peace and development, the sort of things that John F. Kennedy was talking about in his final year. And he appealed precisely to that. In other words, he appealed upwards to this, the norms and the principles and the law of cooperative development, instead of which the United States and its allies decided that to declare themselves the victors, which meant, of course, it was a defeat. A moral and ethical defeat. In claiming victory, they undermined the very possibility of ending entrenched Cold War-style conflict. And in fact, they perpetuated it, and that perpetuation is what led us to the Second Cold War and this hot war in Ukraine. So it's a catastrophe which was made in Washington, the illusions. I mean, it was criticized even there, of course, the great statesman like George Kennan and William Perry, the former defense minister, and so many others warned about this happening.
I'm going to have to end it there. Dr. Richard Sakwa, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to reading your book. I always appreciate the time that we can spend chatting on the radio.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Richard Sakwa, his book is The Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, be my guest, 800-848-9222, 800-848-9222, straight ahead.